This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me now, Kathy Brinkman, former Assistant United States Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, and now with the law firm Porter Wright, and James Pilcher, reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, who wrote a feature story on civil forfeitures that appears in Sunday's Inquirer, and it's already online at Cincinnati.com, right, James?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say that these are designed to help fight drug trafficking. Many now say that this practice is being routinely abused. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kathy, can you start us off by giving us, what's the definition of a civil forfeiture?
A civil forfeiture is allowed by statute. There are federal statutes that allow federal authorities to seize and then transfer ownership to the federal government for the property's involvement in a felony, either the proceeds of a felony, it facilitated a felony, or it's intended to be used in a felony. And you're right. The civil forfeiture laws were broadened and strengthened as part of the war against drugs. Contrast civil forfeiture, which does not require the conviction of any individual, the owner of the property or anybody else, with criminal forfeiture, which is also allowed by statute under federal law. That requires the conviction of an individual by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and then the forfeiture of property that is owned by that convicted individual. Civil forfeiture of property does not require the conviction of anyone.
So you just have to have, if you're a police officer or an agent of the federal government, you just need a probable cause to
right.
do this?
Probable cause is evidence sufficient to arrest an individual for a felony. And that is the standard, the amount of proof that an officer is supposed to have in order to seize cash, a car, or other property for civil forfeiture. The problem is, in practice, the amount of evidence that often is used to seize property is far less than probable cause. Often it is just mere suspicion that the property is the proceeds of a crime, intended to be used in a crime, or facilitated, made a crime easier.
James, when you were writing your story, you came across some examples of what Kathy is talking about, didn't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yeah. Yes. Well, this first came to my attention. I mean, I read other stories nationally about this. There's been major outlets like The New Yorker, Washington Post, even John Oliver on HBO did a piece on it earlier this year. But it kind of crossed our bow because a gentleman who used to live in Cincinnati had his money taken at the airport last year by a couple of local policemen who were deputized as DEA agents as part of the local task force. It was about $11,000. He said he was going to use it to pay his tuition. He acknowledges he'd smoked marijuana earlier in the day. His bag smelled like marijuana, and the dog said, yeah, it smells like marijuana. The drug dog said, yeah. So they met him in the concourse. This was his check bag. So they met him in the concourse, and they said, well, we think we want to check you out. Are you possibly moving drugs? There weren't any drugs in the bag. And they said, well, how much money do you have on you? And he said, I've got this $11,000. And they said, well, we think you're dealing drugs. We're going to take your money. So that came to our attention. The Institute of Justice is representing him out of Washington, a pro bono case. And that led me to think, okay, I've seen this national coverage. I've seen we've got this local case here. How much money are our local agencies making off this? How active are they? So I found out that there are 12 or 13 local agencies who take part in this DEA task force. So I went to each one of them and I said, how much? And that's when I came up with the figure of more than $7 million in the last 5 years. And then, yes, I did find another woman who was – she was actually going through the Dayton airport, not CBG.
So that's $7 million locally?
$7 million locally, just for this one task force that's civil forfeiture funds. So I did find one woman who lost – she got about $11,000 back of it, but she originally was carrying about $20,000 in cash on a trip from Cincinnati to Tucson. She was flying through Dayton, and the dog hit her – brought her into a room where they brought other people, and the agent said, well, I think the dog is sniffing you, so I think that's enough proof that I can take your money. So – and she spent about 6 to 10 months fighting it. Got a local attorney, and by the time all said and done, she wound up settling because it would have taken her forever and all the legal fees. She wound up with about $8,000 back of it.
Now, you said $7 million locally. How much nationally?
Over the last 10 years, it's $4 billion. That's billion with a B.
Are the number of seizures growing?
Yes, they are, both locally and at least the number of dollars is growing significantly. One of the reasons why the local dollars is growing is that more agencies join the task force. And that's what creates what some say is a problem here, is that because of the rules and because of what Kathy was saying, the perceived lack or lax enforcement of the probable cause standard, it creates an incentive and an easy way to get extra cash for your department. Under the federal guidelines, if you're part of this federal task force, you can get up to 80% back of the money that you seized. The government keeps 20%. And then the 80% comes back, and then they split it up amongst the rest of the task force, depending on who did the arrest, where it occurred, how active you are. So some of these agencies might have one person, some might have two, and so on. The agency locally that received the most money is the CBG Airport Police, because a lot of the seizures are taking place at the airport. And they are very active out there. But to be fair, the case,
they have a lot of people passing through their doors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And to be fair, the case that I wrote about actually occurred in Dayton, but it's the same scenario. And then the Charles Clark case, those were not CVG officers. There was a CVG officer assisting the situation, but the actual guy who arrested was a Covington police officer who had been deputized as a DEA agent. So you can see the tangled web of all of this. But like I said, CVG got the most back, about $1.9 million in the last 5 years.
Now, Kathy, you've been on both sides of this issue as a prosecutor and now as a defense attorney. And
right.
What is your take on civil forfeiture?
The last time that civil forfeiture was reformed was in 2000. But what we have seen happen since 2000 is that there are serious problems, although it's legal, keeping it constitutional as applied and protecting individuals' rights who are actually innocent and who should have a fair chance to contest the forfeiture of property that is seized from them. I mean, one big thing that has been proposed is removing the financial incentive for police officers and federal officers, either working on a task force or not, because their agencies receive the benefit of completed forfeitures. So if you remove the financial incentive, it should help the fairness of the system and not make it, in order to support their organizations, take as much as they can. And that's a big problem. More oversight of the way in which forfeitures, seizures first, and then forfeitures are carried out. There's very little review beyond an agency until someone formally files a claim with the agency contesting the seizure, and it goes to the U.S. Attorney's Office to file a civil lawsuit against the seized property. That's really the first time where an independent review occurs. These are not seizures in which there's a warrant issued and a review by a judicial officer of the evidence that supports the seizure before it happens.
And in most cases, not to interrupt, but in most cases, people don't contest it. So it never gets reviewed. The government just keeps the money.
Why don't they contest it?
Legal fees. They can't afford a lawyer. It's not enough money because a lot of things might be $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. Right. The legal fees would eat up that money they would get back anyway. Maybe they did have a little bit of a criminal past and they don't want that brought into it. There's all kinds of reasons. Kathy can get into that because she defends some of these people. But like I said, and the barrier is so high to get your money back. You have to prove it's reverse of if you go to jail, right? And if you go to jail, you're innocent until proven guilty if you're arrested for something. In the case of your property is guilty until proven innocent. The burden is on you as an individual to prove to not even a judge, to prove to the U.S. attorney in that office initially that asset, that money, whatever, was not going to be used in a criminal offense. So it's crazy backwards in the way it's set up.
Is there any recourse for someone who goes to court and wins to make the government pay those legal fees, though?
Yes, there is a provision in the law, but it's almost impossible for someone who is successful in contesting a forfeiture to recover those fees because the proof that you have to give to the court in order to get the government to pay your attorney's fees, if you're successful, is so high. You have to actually prove that the government acted in bad faith and did not have a reasonable basis for going forward. And that's almost impossible to show. And you know what Jim said?
So your standard of proof is higher than what they have.
Yeah. What Jim said is the reality of how it works when you actually get to court. The law has provided since 2000 that the government must show the forfeitability of the property just like they would in another civil case. That's by a preponderance of the evidence. That's slightly more than even, more likely than not. But often, people cannot afford, the law does not provide for the appointment of counsel to represent someone who wants to contest a civil forfeiture but cannot afford an attorney, unless it's your primary residence. So in these small cash forfeitures, these small seizures, even up to $10,000, $12,000, most attorneys will not take it on a contingency basis and say, I will get paid if I recover your money or part of your money for you. They want a retainer and they want to be paid by the hour. And it is simply not economically possible. You would spend $10,000 in attorney's fees to get back $10,000.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. You can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kathy, of the federal courts, how much have they weighed in on this?
So few of these civil forfeiture seizures get to trial with a verdict where there could be an appeal, that there's very little case law that helps owners of property that is seized. Yes, it does happen. Most of these seizures result in either a forfeiture by default because no one makes a formal claim to the property and contests the forfeiture, or they result in a compromise at the administrative level or in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and you get some of the money back, and you give the government a release saying that you're not going to make any complaint about how the property was seized.
Which is what was done in the case of Ms. Lattimore, who I wrote about. Again, it was an economic decision for her and a time decision for her. By the time that all said and done, she only got $8,000 of her nearly $20,000 that she had.
So, James, how do supporters of civil forfeiture, what arguments do they make in favor of it?
And there are some strong ones. And to be fair, and Kathy can speak to this as well, because she ran civil forfeitures for the local U.S. Attorney's Office for a while. It can be used, if used effectively, can be used to disrupt drug traffic and terror and potential terror networks, because this money does move around. Pro-law enforcement advocates say it's I won't say easier way to get at the flow of money than just arresting people. But I think that that's the implied implication is that, you know, if you can take the money, you can disrupt the money, you can disrupt that particular drug deal or that drug network.
And I agree with Jim completely. There are valid and important law enforcement uses of civil forfeiture. Among other things, in white-collar cases, civil forfeiture is used to restrain and then forfeit money that's returned to victims of white-collar crime. It is used to break up substantial criminal organizations, not just drug organizations, but identity theft organizations and Ponzi schemes.
It's funny she should mention the white collar crime. If you look at, we have a chart online. If you look at the national numbers, and they climb steadily, and all of a sudden in 2013 they spike. That was Bernie Madoff. And that was also one of the another Wall Street firm, and that was a civil forfeiture, and they took that money, they grabbed that money, and a lot of it went back to the victims of those Ponzi schemes.
One of the things that is so key in federal forfeiture is the integrity and good judgment of the attorneys who work for the government. Just like prosecutors, whose duty is not to win, not to get statistics, but to do justice, civil forfeiture attorneys for the government have that same obligation. And just because you can, under the statute, doesn't mean you should pursue forfeiture. You have to have good judgment and a sense of proportionality when you pursue the forfeiture civilly, because there are so few protections and means for people to contest and protect what's otherwise innocent property.
But that being said, a lot of times, there is at least the impression in the community that wants to either reform or get rid of this entirely, that not to be confrontational, but that it's a rubber stamp and that it really never becomes a review to that justice until the person actually challenges it. So in the case of Ms. Lattimore, that would have gone through entirely and the government would have kept all $20,000 of her money pretty much without any protest, with the potentially getting a cursory look if she hadn't protested it and filed an official complaint. So that's the thing that people want to reform the most is, like she said, the oversight of this, the ability to make it easier on people to, if they feel like they've been wronged, to go get their money back. And we're not even talking, this is just federal right now. We're not even talking about state law, which is an entirely different rat's nest of all kinds of problems. If you read the talk about the New Yorker piece, they were taking money just off people off the side of the road and threatening to put their kids in jail. And then the money would wind up back in the DA's, local DA's campaign fund.
So there are more problems at the state level.
Oh, yeah. Kentucky basically doesn't have a law. You take whatever the local agency takes, they get to keep. In Ohio, it's a 50-50 split between the local agency and the local DA's office. So and the preponderance of proving it is different at every state. So there's all kinds of efforts to reform both the state and the federal law.
And so $7 million locally, $4 billion nationally. But what are they using the money for?
They can't use it for anything within their ordinary operating budget. So they can't pay salaries with it. They can't do regular maintenance with it. Those kinds of things that they regularly budget. What it is used for is extra equipment, extra training, replacement equipment that otherwise wouldn't be afforded. In my story, I talk about how the airport is using $200,000 of their money to buy a new SWAT van. Their current SWAT van is 22, 23 years old. There were some that questioned whether or not they needed a SWAT van. It's not as big as an airport as it used to be, but there are also those who say they need it if they need it. I mean, we have presidents flying in. We've got Air Force One coming here quite a bit, things like that. So, but nationally, there are all kinds of stories of abuse and questionable spending on this. In Texas, they bought a margarita machine. There's other places that have bought a Viper, a Dodge Viper.
A Dodge Viper, yeah.
A Dodge Viper as their speed car. So, all those kinds of things, it leaves it up to the judgment of the local law enforcement officials. They're supposed to fill out forms and list with the Department of Justice when it's a federal seizure what they're spending the money on. Those records are hard to get to.
You're talking about groups that are behind reforming this. Who are some of the...
Well, there's a new one called Fix Forfeiture, which is just starting up, and it's a really interesting amalgamation and strange bedfellows of the ACLU and some actual conservative Christian groups who have banded together. Kind of a civil libertarian coalition. Rand Paul has been putting forth legislation in the Senate. Thomas Massey has matched that legislation in the House. And actually, the fixed forfeiture thing is led by a woman who's from Kentucky. She worked for Agriculture Commissioner James Comer for a while. So there's some local ties to this. And one of their targets is the Ohio state law next year in the next legislative session. They want to fix the Ohio law as one of their first targets.
Why are they looking at Ohio specifically?
I think it's because it's a swing state. And they want to make it a national issue.
So, Kathy, I think you said the last time we had any kind of changes made to civil forfeiture was 2000. Is that right?
Those were the last major changes.
Okay. How likely are we to see changes in these laws
I think there's a fair probability because civil forfeiture reform is viewed as part of criminal justice reform. And it should be because it is part of the criminal justice system. And Jim's right. You have everybody from the Koch brothers on one end to the ACLU and the NAACP on the other end of the spectrum who are interested in criminal justice reform and civil forfeiture reform. It could be part of it.
James, how likely is it that we'll see reforms? What do you think?
I don't think we're going to see a ton until somebody, a major leader in either House of Congress or a presidential candidate makes this a major issue. And I'm not talking about, in the milieu of the current Republican race. I'm talking about when we get down to the final two or three candidates that it becomes a talking point.
Do you really think it will become a major issue?
I got to tell you, I've known about this issue for 2 years. And when I wrote this story, I have an editor My editor on this story said, I never heard about this. This makes me so angry. And there are people out there who do not know that this even exists, much less that it's going on so blatantly and so widespread. So I think there's a lot of education nationally that still needs to go on about this before any kind of reform happens. I bet you congressmen, there are congressmen who don't even know about this.
You planning any follow-up on this?
Yes, I'm going to be digging into the state laws. I'm going to be digging into what other agencies have gotten back from state forfeitures and what efforts are being made in that area.
James and Kathy, thanks for joining me this afternoon. Kathy Brinkman is a former assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, and she's now with the law firm of Porter Wright. And James Pilcher, who is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And you can read his story about the federal seizure program in Sunday's edition of the Cincinnati Inquirer, or you can see it online at cincinnati.com. Up next, a new effort to attract and train workers for manufacturing jobs in our region. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.